Thank you for listening in to the Aquila Group of Funds podcast. I'll be your host today, Phil Felice, the Director of Internal Sales here at Aquila. And joining me, as always, is Tony Tanner, the Portfolio Manager of the Aquila Tax-Free Trust of Arizona. So we're here in mid-November, coming to the end of the year, and a year in munis that will be discussed and dissected for likely decades. As we usually do, we'll be discussing all matters regarding the municipal bond markets and touch a little bit on the local Arizona economy. As always, welcome, Tony, and thank you for being part of the podcast.
Hey, thank you, Phil. It's great to participate. And like you said, boy, there's a lot to talk about.
Sure. So let's dive right in. And as we said, so much has happened this year in the fixed income market and beyond. Can you speak to how the municipal market has transformed this year? How do you see muni bond yields and prices currently looking, both as an asset class and relative to other asset classes?
Well, as we look at the asset class today, a couple things stand out. First of all, the muni curve is still has a pretty normal positive slope compared to the very inverted shape of the U.S. Treasury curve. And municipal market yields on a relative basis are much more attractive than they were at this time last year. This morning we're looking at benchmark AAA yields at about 70% of U.S. Treasury yields under 10 years. You go out further, you're talking 80 to 95%, but that sort of belies the value out there beyond 10 years. In that intermediate range, there's a plentiful amount of good quality AA revenue bonds that are at north of 4% at 110 to 125% of Treasury bonds. In fact, today I was seeing an offering on some AA and even AAA revenue bonds in 25 years, offered a yield of 4.25%, which is more than what the 30-year U.S. Treasury is yielding. So there's a lot of good value in the muni market right now. And it's a good opportunity to sort of compare to where we were a year ago, where those same yields were in sort of the 1% to 2% range. And a strong demand for munis with the prospect of higher marginal tax rates had muni valuations much more expensive. But here we are a year later with the Federal Reserve having increased the Fed funds rate significantly from 25 basis points to 4%. And what we have is the Fed has really created a condition where the investable yields in the muni market provide a much more viable long-term entry point that may not have existed a year ago. And in terms of considering the muni asset class, it's certainly very cheap on a relative basis. This past week or a couple weeks ago, we saw an offering sheet on large, high-quality airport revenue bonds from across a variety of issuers with 5% coupons due in 25 to 30 years that were all at discount prices. And so in terms of characterizing the state of the muni market and values, I've often found that the muni treasury ratios and valuation metrics are sometimes a better indicator of what not to do rather than what to do. And so, in current conditions with what I think are really extremely cheap valuations, if you have not already exited the muni market for whatever cash raising or rebalancing needs, I think we're at a point where the opportunity cost of foregone income and being on the sidelines too long has become greater than any remaining interest rate risk we have with this Fed cycle.
Thanks, Tony. And let's stay on that. That was obviously the headline topic for 2022, interest rates and inflation. Give us your thoughts on the Fed's current positioning and possibly where they head next.
Well, I've talked about this a lot recently with our constituents. And, in my 30 years experience of managing open-end municipal bond funds across a whole host of market conditions, this year really has a lot more familiarity and has unfolded very similar to the bond bear markets of 1994 and 1998, and in particular 1994. A lot of the comparisons that you see are made to what I call a lot of the new century dislocations we've seen since 2000, whether that's the credit crisis or the 60 Minutes interview or the taper tantrum. Those bond downdrafts, with hindsight, for investors with a long-term perspective, really turned out to be short-lived distractions. And going back to the 90s, you know, we're in the first truly Fed-driven bond bear market since 1994 and 1998. And the big difference is that, you know, the disruptions we've seen since 2000 were primarily situational. Here, the decline in bond prices and increases in yields is primarily a function of just the math of market yields. And so I think that has a lot of implications for how you evaluate the market. If you take a look at industry inflows back in those periods, you know, we're seeing a similar pattern we've seen now, and that is organically, industry inflows probably aren't going to return to the muni market until prices stop dropping. And if you take a look at 1994 and 1998, the 1994 bear market bears most resemblance to this one. Alan Greenspan at that time took Fed funds to 3 to 6% in a span of about 10 months, which drove up 10-year benchmark muni yields about 140 basis points. But afterwards, the inflation risk that he was concerned with didn't really materialize because of a lot of technology, productivity in the economy, and rates began to recede for the next 4 years. And so, you know, we're at a point where once with inflation possibly appearing to be cooling right now, you know, it's a good time to consider how fixed income can allow you to accomplish long-term income-oriented objectives in a way that that we haven't been able to see done in several years.
Great. And so, as we said, the Fed and inflation has been the market driver this year. But what are the other market drivers currently at play? And I guess the real question is, are there any other market drivers currently?
Industry inflows are an important driver because it's one of the primary contributors to keeping the municipal asset class as cheap as it is right now. Without inflows and with the modest redemptions that the industry is experiencing, there just isn't the same level of demand that we saw a year ago when everybody was certain that the Build Back Better proposal would pass and marginal tax rates were going to go up. And that's created a very good opportunity on a relative value basis. I mean, let's face it, if you can buy, you know, an intermediate portfolio that the underlying bonds are at a market yield of 3.5% or 4% tax-free, your question becomes, why don't I want the Fed to raise interest rates? Why don't I want the Fed to get inflation under control? Because now I have a chance to lock in an attractive long-term income stream.
So let's pivot a little to credit strength, what that looks like in the municipal bond market, both at a macro level and, of course, at the Arizona level. For anyone who's listening that is concerned about the state of our economy, how would you assess the conditions of credit?
Well, the credit fundamentals right now are very good. You know, coming out of the pandemic with both the recovery and, you know, $8 trillion of fiscal stimulus, starting with the $6 trillion that was distributed in 2020, municipal credit is extremely firm. You know, here in Arizona, you know, the most recent budget report showed that 2020 fiscal revenues are 12% ahead of budget. And $300 million ahead of this point last year, and the state is sitting with an $11 billion operating surplus. And at the state and local level, we've seen local revenue streams weather the pandemic very well and actually begin to accelerate. A recent bond issue by one of the state's largest issuers, the Phoenix Civic Improvement Authority, had some great information about that entity's revenue stream, and they collect tax revenues and excise tax revenues from a whole wide variety of sources. Year over year, those revenues actually grew 2.5% during the pandemic, and last year advanced about 5%. So, you know, from a credit standpoint, Arizona and its local issuers are situated very well.
Staying in Arizona, specifically, and maybe broader than credit, anything else happening locally that our listeners should be aware about in the muni markets?
Well, I think something that's very important for our constituents consider is an increasing level of relative value in Arizona munis. You know, that Phoenix Civic Improvement Authority issue I mentioned, and when it came to market back in the midsummer, the yield spreads that the bonds were priced at above a normal benchmark AAA bond were about 50 to 55 basis points. A year ago, the same issuer came to market, and that spread was only about 11 basis points. So relative to the national market, the Arizona municipal bond market has actually underperformed slightly in the last 12 to 15 months and is trading at levels and values that I've not seen in 20 years in Arizona. And again, going back to my prior comments, that to me is an indication of how cheap the asset class is and indicates the kind of opportunity cost that might not be really on the surface when investors are considering what to do with their existing holdings. So for me as a professional manager and in the market on a day-to-day basis, it's breeding a lot of opportunity to put money to work effectively and to also somewhat restructure the portfolio for the current rate environment.
Thank you, Tony. The midterm elections, they're now behind us. And I think we saw, whether it's anywhere north or south of $60 billion of ballot measures for local municipal projects. Anything noteworthy there inside Arizona?
There wasn't anything really noteworthy on the issuance front. It was sort of your garden variety lineup of smaller school district issues. Biggest development in the state is its emergence as the smart manufacturing hub just keeps rolling on. Just yesterday, Taiwan Semiconductor announced an additional $12 billion semiconductor plant commitment to Northwest Phoenix on top of the existing $12 billion plant that it's building, and that its intentions are over the next 5 to 10 years to invest about $35 billion in state-of-the-art semiconductor manufacturing. And we're already beginning to see the peripheral benefits along the Northwest Loop 303 corridor, where lots of smaller suppliers to Taiwan Semiconductor are moving in. We're seeing valuable real estate development for mixed use and residential properties. And the implications there are pretty substantial and positive for that part of the valley. When you think about some of the outlying towns like Wickenburg and Black Canyon City, that the space is filling in. A few years ago, Honor Health opened a hospital facility out there with its emergency room facility. And so, it's really nice progress from that front. We're also seeing some increased breadth in who is coming here. Procter & Gamble just announced a manufacturing facility in Pinal County that will employ 500 people. And Pinal County is becoming somewhat of a manufacturing hotbed itself for more traditional manufacturers. And, it's becoming sort of the hotbed of the Phoenix-Tucson corridor. And so it's good to see some geographic dispersion within the state's growth. The other thing to me of note is, despite the huge run-up in mortgage rates, Arizona's housing market is actually holding up pretty well. And while year-over-year housing permits are down about 10%, they still came in last month at around 43,000 single-family permits on an annual basis, which is a very healthy amount for real estate and all the ancillary industries that support it here in Arizona.
Thank you, Tony. So I have one more question I want to close out today. We talk a lot to our clients and to advisors about our process, that we're up in quality and that we manage from a local perspective. But for anybody new, for anybody looking at Aquila, thinking about using our fund lineup, can you give us, I guess, a 10,000-foot view on the strategy of the Arizona Fund?
Certainly. I can tell you what we have done in Arizona and where we're situated now. I began a pretty defensive shortening starting in the fourth quarter of last year. I had a pretty strong feeling that the failure of the Build Back Better bill and the inaction on marginal income tax rates would probably remove some of the demand for munis by a lot of the non-traditional buyers that have been in the market. And so I took down the fund's average maturity from 12 to 10 years by the end of 2021. And that's been a big benefit for our shareholders, as we've seen, the significant increase in interest rates. And throughout the year, I've continued to more defensively position the fund's final maturity exposure. We came in last quarter around 8.5 years. At the same time, though, we're restructuring to take advantage of a steeper yield curve and the value of being in the intermediate space. We've actually extended duration slightly from 5 to 5.5 years. And what we've done is we've mitigated a lot of the call risk in the front end of the portfolio, where once you get beyond the Fed tightening cycle and rates start going down, bonds that are approaching their call dates are of a much higher risk of being called away. And so we've been able to insulate the fund from a great degree of the long-term yield volatility, where price sensitivity is greatest, but at the same time, stick with a high-quality intermediate portfolio that is now positioned to better roll down the yield curve and have better long-term total return possibilities, all with the same strong AA level of average credit quality.
Thanks a lot, Tony. A lot of information. Any kind of last words or last thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
Phil, I do. You know, the popular mantra in markets like this is to don't fight the Fed. But I would really encourage people at this point, don't reject the Fed. The Fed has done a significant favor to fixed income participants by returning income to the fixed income market. And it's really a whole new and better ballgame for income-oriented investors, especially those approaching retirement. And so the 60-40 asset allocation proposition works significantly better than it did a year ago because there is actual income in the 40. And so this may present an opportunity to deploy some of that sideline money and to lock in income for a long-term basis, because by doing so, you may be able to diverse away some of the reinvestment risk that could come about should we see an abrupt change in Fed policy this year.
Tony, as always, thank you for joining us today. I know I always find these discussions incredibly insightful, and I hope our clients and the advisor universe feel the same way. So thank you. Have a great day, and I guess have a great rest of your year.
Thanks very much, Phil. Thanks for having me on today.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. The opinions shared are those of the portfolio managers and do not necessarily reflect those of the investment advisor or sub-advisor of the fund. Before investing in a fund, carefully read about and consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and other information found in the fund prospectus. The prospectus is available from your financial advisor when you visit www.aquilafunds.com or call 1-800-437-1020. Mutual fund investing involves risk. Loss of principal is possible. Investments in bonds may decline in value due to rising interest rates, a real or perceived decline in the credit quality of an issuer, borrower, counterparty, or collateral, adverse tax or legislative changes, court decisions, market or economic conditions. Fund performance could be more volatile than that of the funds with greater geographic diversification. For more information on the entire Aquila group of funds, please visit www.aquilafunds.com. The fund seeks to provide a high level of income exempt from state and federal income tax, as is consistent with capital preservation. Past performance does not guarantee future results. For certain investors, some dividends may be subject to federal and state income taxes, including the alternative minimum tax referred to as AMP. Please consult your tax professional. Independent rating services such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch assign ratings which generally range from AAA, which is the highest, to D, the lowest, to indicate the creditworthiness of underlying bonds in the portfolio. Where the independent rating services differ in the rating assigned to an issue or do not provide a rating for an issue, the highest available rating is used in calculating allocations by rating. Free refunded or escrowed bonds are issued to retire or regain an outstanding bond issue at a specific call date. Until the call date, the proceeds of the bond issuance are typically placed in a trust and invested in U.S. Treasury bonds or state and local government securities. Modified and effective duration both measure the value of a security in response to a change in interest rates. Effective duration is also taken into account the effect of embedded options. The weighted average life, also referred to as weighted average maturity, is a reflection of the quickness with which the principal of an issue is expected to be paid. A credit spread is a difference in yield between two bonds of similar maturity but different credit quality. Taxable equivalent yield is the return that is required on a taxable investment to make it equal to the return on a tax-exempt investment. For certain investors, net investment income tax, known as NIIT, may apply. NIIT is a 3.8% tax established by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that applies to the lesser of the net amount income or a taxpayer's modified adjusted gross income above an applicable threshold amount. Yield refers to earnings generated and realized on an investment over a specific period. Yield is expressed as a percentage based on the investment amount, current market value, or face value of the security, and includes the interest earned or dividend received from holding a particular security. The yield ratio represents the comparison of the expected yield of one bond to the expected yield of another. A yield ratio is important when deciding whether to invest in one bond or another. Generally, the higher yield is considered better.